I'm Sean Graham, and what's old as news this week is Women United, which is the title of a new book by Peggy Nash and Julie White, Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union. And what this book does is it profiles women, and there are many contributions to the CAW from its origins in the 1930s all the way through the 21st century. A really fascinating profile, and the older material, the stuff from the 1930s, uses both primary and secondary sources. And then once we get into the second half of the 20th century and certainly into the 21st century, uses a lot of firsthand accounts and interviews that were done with the women who shaped the union and its priorities. One of whom is Peggy Nash, who was a lead negotiator for the union. So it's really interesting to go through the book and to explore how women in different eras exerted their influence over the union, how they brought different issues to union leadership, and how instrumental they were in the effort and the push for equality, not only within the union, but within the workplace. And with union participation decreasing in Canada over the past 40 years, it's a very interesting description of how unionization matters and the influence and power that unions can have, both for those individuals in unionized workplaces, but how that extends out to non-unionized labor as well. So I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to talk with Peggy Nash. As I said, she was a lead negotiator for the union before she entered into federal politics, was an MP. And since she left the House of Commons, this is one of the many projects that she has been working on, of course, with Julie White. So I really enjoyed this conversation. I think you will as well. So let's get right to my chat with Peggy Nash. All right. And Peggy Nash joins me now. Peggy, how are you today?
I'm very well, Sean. How are you?
Doing really well. Very excited to talk to you about Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union that you co-wrote with Julie White. So before we get into some of the specifics here that are in the book, you have a very interesting background of, as you know, an MP. You've been in politics, been an advocate for women. So why go into this particular book? Why go into history and delve into to that?
Well, I've spent most of my life in the union movement, in the labor movement, as a negotiator, as a human rights advocate, and involved in many different campaigns over the years, everything from working against free trade to promoting childcare. And you know, this has been, the union really has been so fundamental in my life. And I think my co-author, Julie White, felt the same way, that, and so did most of the women we spoke with. The union was so fundamental in their lives and offered them so many opportunities. For example, I never would have thought to run for elected office if I hadn't spent so much of my career in the labor movement. So because it was so fundamental, and I feel that we had the privilege of being in the union in a period of significant change. No one had recorded this before. We needed to do it.
So for you, how much of the book is archival research, right? It goes back to the origins of the union back in the 1930s up to and through the 21st century. So doing the research, I know you talked to a lot of folks, there's a lot of firsthand accounts in there, but did we also you and Julie do archival work and go back? And how did you try to situate those early years where we don't have that much living memory left?
Yeah, certainly it's before my living memory. And but we did have access to an author, Wendy Cuthbertson, who is one of the women we interviewed for the book, who did her PhD thesis on the role of unions during the war years. And she called it Labor Goes to War. And we really relied on much of her research, where she really did go back into archives She read old union newspapers and minutes of meetings. She really did the legwork to record all of that history. And frankly, we built on the work she did in addition to interviews with her, because she later worked with the auto workers.
Okay. So, as you said, the union in the book starts in the 1930s. I think a lot of people might be surprised at when the Canadian Auto Workers Union, when it actually is formalized in the late 1930s. I think most people would have assumed it was a little earlier, just given the industry at the time. So what were some of the initial pushes that the union was going for, and how did women fit into that early story where, again, the idea I think that we all have of the 1930s is, you know, women are in the domestic sphere for the most part, and it's the men who are in the industrial space.
Mm-hmm. Well, the 1930s, we also think of as an era of scarcity, yeah, as well, yeah, because of the Great Depression. I mean, unions go back and workers organizing go back well before that into the 19th century. And certainly there are examples back then when workers organized, they had strikes, they challenged their employer, but there was nothing or little in the way of labor law that enshrined their rights. So they might have a strike, they might resolve an issue, but they didn't have any law to fall back on. So during the 30s, there was a big push to organize workers who had until then been seen as unorganizable. What I mean by that is, before that, unions focused on skilled workers. So if you had a trade, that was knowledge, that skill protected you. You weren't easily replaceable. But in the 1930s, there was a big expansion into mass manufacturing, auto plants, aerospace, other forms of equipment in the U.S., in Canada. And you couldn't organize around the scarcity of skill because these were unskilled workers. So unions very cleverly found they had their power in gumming up the production. And so if you struck the employer, they couldn't make vehicles, they couldn't make lighting, they couldn't make all of the things that manufacturing facilities were making then. And unions tried different tactics over the years, the sit-down strike. There was the famous blockade in 1945 where cars jammed the Ford plant to prevent them from operating. So workers couldn't rely on their skill, but they could rely on their numbers and the power that they had to stop production. And the reason they fought for better working conditions, even though it was a period of high unemployment, was because, well, first of all, there were no laws protecting them. And, you know, many people felt they had nothing left to lose because they had to fight for their rights. And this movement under the umbrella of an organization called the Congress of Industrial Organizations was the driving force in North America, a mass mobilization of unskilled industrial workers. And the auto workers were part of that. They were caught up in that.
I think one of the things that for the auto industry in Canada, it's for the most part centered in Southern and Southwestern Ontario. And, you know, some of the early strikes, like there's the one in Oshawa in 1937 at the GM plant. And I think that makes sense, the connection to the American market with the manufacturing in Detroit. But in terms of the broad movement, is the auto workers really borrowing and connecting with a national labor movement? Or is it very much centered in where the manufacturing is taking place?
It is very much building on what is happening in the U.S. in similar industries. And that, I should say, the auto industry in Canada goes back way before that, McKinnon Industries in Oshawa, way before General Motors, way before the auto workers. So there are deep roots in that sector. But the Canadian auto workers really became a section of the United Auto Workers, the American right. Union. And Walter Reuther was the leader of that union. He was this iconic labor leader, imperfect as everyone is, but nevertheless, he led incredible organizing drives. And just as the Canadian factories of Ford, GM, Chrysler were offshoots of American manufacturing, the unions similarly were tied to U.S. organizations. And you find that not only in auto, but in many other industries, in steel, in rubber, in aerospace. And many of these unions, even today, are Canadian divisions of American organizations.
And that makes sense, just given the nature of the work and the industry in general. Now, shortly after the union is formalized, the Second World War breaks out in the fall of 1939. Again, I think the literature generally talks about this being very transformational for women in the workforce, particularly in industrial workspaces. As it relates to the auto workers union, what is the impact of the Second World War on women and their participation in the industry?
Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't fully answer part of your previous question about what role did women play before the war. And I should say, you know, there were many women that always worked. You know, there were working class women couldn't necessarily just stay home and look after kids. Often they had to work, and they worked in nursing, they worked in textiles, food processing, a number of areas, but in manufacturing, there were very few women, but there were some women, but they also supported the actions of men. They formed what were called ladies' auxiliaries initially, and they certainly helped with picket line support and building community support for strikes, which is a very important part. But during the war, of course, there was a limited labor supply because men went off to fight. And so women were drawn into the plants, especially into manufacturing. We have the image of Rosie the Riveter. Yeah. But there were, in fact, many women who built aircraft, who built cars, who worked in all kinds of industries. And at that time, employers were quite happy to hire women because they could pay them less. And so that became a huge bone of contention. And it still is today under the title of pay equity. But at that point, they could pay women for doing the same job, they could pay them less. So that became a key factor in organizing drives to get women to join unions.
And so as women are joining the unions throughout the war and getting involved more and more in manufacturing and within the auto manufacturing industry, does that change the union at all? Are the women bringing different things, different priorities, different things they want to push for?
As you can well imagine, they did, because obviously equal pay was a major factor. Pushing for childcare, predictable hours of work. And when women did get involved in the union, and they weren't necessarily easily involved, they did also change the union. But, you know, initially, union organizers complained that women were difficult to organize. And it's not surprising. They got paid less than men. They still had to go home and cook meals and look after kids and do housework. I mean, it was, you know, even more challenging at that point in history. So, and women didn't feel initially that the union was fighting for them. So why would they get involved? And that became a challenge for unions to try to overcome that lack of involvement. And eventually they did.
And are women seeking out leadership positions in the union through the war and the immediate post-war period? Are they advocating not only through sort of maybe writing letters or going to meetings, but also trying to get into the leadership positions within the union?
On a very limited basis, for the reasons that I've just said, that they had a lot of other things to do. What they did do, though, is pressure for equal pay. That became a real driving force. And what unions found is that if they promoted the idea of equal pay, they could get women interested in joining the union. And initially, men saw equal pay as a way of not discriminating against men. Because if you could undercut their wages with women, that wasn't very good. And if you could divide the workforce by not including women in the union, that was difficult. And remember, there were no laws that said if you worked at General Motors or at, you know, an aerospace company, that you were part of the union. This was all voluntary.
Right.
And there was no what was called dues checkoff. What would happen is union representatives would have to go around each month, kind of cap in hand, to get each worker to put their dues money in order to run the union. So it was a very insecure base to have this kind of organization. So the more members you had, the more people who signed on, the more people who paid dues, the stronger the organization. And remember, the war is going on and people are, you know, the Allied soldiers are fighting against fascism and they are fighting for democracy and human rights. And eventually the pay, the equal pay argument became to be seen not just as a way of not undercutting men's wages, but as a principle of human rights, as something that should be in a democratic society. And so that argument about human rights and fighting for democracy, fighting against fascism, changed the union, and it equipped them better to be able to take up the fight for women. So it made a real change in the approach of unions.
And that's good, because the union should be responsive to its membership. And yeah, maybe it's not great that you have to go around every month and collect the dues, but if it forces you to be very responsive, that's, I guess there's a push-pull in there. Now, in the post-war period, a lot has been written about, I think most kids across the country will be taught, as soldiers come home, there's tension now between women who have joined the labor force and soldiers coming home. As it relates to the auto workers union, how do they navigate this post-war era of soldiers coming home, expecting to go back to the same jobs? And then you have women who have clearly demonstrated they're capable of doing these jobs, and a lot of them want to continue to do those jobs.
Yeah, and so many women wanted to, and there were surveys, and Wendy Cuthbertson has this in her book, that not everyone, there was huge public pressure and social pressure for women to go back into the home. That's what women did. But there's no question, the war years changed women. It showed them that there was a whole other world of possibilities that could give them more economic clout, more possibilities. It changed them. And, you know, looking later to their daughters who became second wave feminists, they benefited from the fact that their mothers had been changed by the Second World War and their role in it. I mean, my own mother, she didn't work in a heavy manufacturing plant, but she made wallets at King and Spadina. And that was her job. So women worked, and you know, there were a number of women who continued after the war, who stayed in the workplace, but there was so much social pressure, and the dominant societal attitude was that women's place was in the home, and you know, working people reflect the general society. And so there was a lot of pressure on women to leave those jobs. Not everybody did. Mm-hmm. And the memory of that experience, I think, brought a lot of women back into those workplaces not too long after.
Yeah, and the book profiles that and talks about that. And if we jump ahead, you get into the 70s and the early 1980s, and there's so as we get into the second chapter of the book, it is titled Union Women Winning Victories. So what are some of the key moments of that stretch in the late 70s and the early 1980s that really stand out to you?
Mm-hmm. I think the two big issues in that area are affirmative action and reproductive choice or abortion rights. There was, we talk about the abortion caravan that went across Canada, and one of the women we interviewed who became the health and safety director of the Canadian Auto Workers, Kathy Walker, she drove the bus of the abortion caravan. And it was a pretty radical group of women that were right across the country and up to Ottawa. And there was huge pressure. These were the Morgenthaler years, where the Morgenthaler Clinic was firebombed, and that became a galvanizing force. And that went into the labor movement, where this became a very polarizing but ultimately galvanizing issue for women. The other big issue was representation. And there was a real push for women's representation, initially to have a women's committee. But because none of the union leaders were women, it was chaired by two men at the Ontario Federation of Labor. And they, you know, we interviewed one of those men, and he was a good ally for women, but he recognized that maybe there should have been a woman there. So there was finally a women's committee that started. I remember those days, the push beforehand. And then there was a real push for women in leadership. And part of that was an affirmative action measure to have women on the executive of the Ontario Federation of Labor. Because at that time, there were almost no women who were heads of their unions. These were called equity positions, opportunities for women and eventually racialized and other groups to get this representation. And what it showed the women who got a chance to do that was that they could do these positions. And some of them went on and did head up their unions. But it also showed the rest of the labor movement that there was a lot of talent there, that they could aspire to these positions, do a great job. And some of the, you know, one of the first women on the, one of the affirmative action spots went on to head up the Ontario Federation of Labor, which is today headed by a woman. So it just coincided with this big push for women to get out of the home, to get equality, to have equal rights, and to gain representation.
And then as we go through the 1980s, it's a decade where you see a lot of cuts in public services, both in Canada and the United States. Of course, major debate around free trade in the auto sector. The auto pact has already been in place. But how are women navigating within the union this really transformative decade, the 1980s, particularly where the labor movement has a strong voice in a lot of those trades around, along with the debates around free trade in the late 1980s?
This was a period when Bob White was the president of the auto workers, and he really carved his reputation in collective bargaining. And it was a period when the auto companies were struggling with the arrival of imports from Asia, mainly Japanese imports, and it was hurting the American market share. And so the companies were calling for cutbacks, and Bob White gained, you know, incredible presence because he had to fight both the companies and his American-based union in opposing these cutbacks, and eventually led the Canadian section of the United Auto Workers into forming a new Canadian union. And it was a turbulent period, so white was extremely high profile in this period. We go into the free trade debate. Brian Mulroney is prime minister. And I'll never forget when Barbara Frum, who headed up a program called The Journal, the top most watched media discussion, media program focused on current issues. And Bob White and Maude Barlow from the Council of Canadians squared off with Tom DeKino and Premier Lougheed from Alberta. And it was like a fishbowl with each side, you know, one pro-free trade, one opposite free trade. And a bunch of us were there cheering on our respective. And this was on national television. I think it was an hour each, two nights in a row. It might have been a half an hour each. I don't remember, but it was spectacular debate. And it's hard to imagine today a union leader getting that kind of profile and that kind of recognition. So Bob was, he saw his role as really forming a different kind of union based on human rights and advocating for women's equality, anti-racism. He became very close to Nelson Mandela in South Africa. And it was a period when things seemed really difficult because of the free trade fight, which ultimately Mulroney was successful. But also it was a period when women were really fighting to gain more rights, and Bob was he was a willing partner for us in that regard.
Does the union see the same shift to conservative ideology that you see in popular politics, like national politics, through that era? Like, are union members going through and kind of having the same thing, the same approach to issues that you see broadly across the country? Is the union, I mean, I think most people would associate unions with being like left of center organizations, but in this era of a very strong conservative movement, both in Canada, the United States, Great Britain as well, like there are strong conservative leaders as the head of government nationally in all these places. Is the union seeing a similar transformation or similar ideas being brought by members?
In the 1980s, I don't think so. I really don't. I mean, in the free trade fight, there were mass meetings held in a number of southwestern Ontario communities. And so it wasn't just a handful of leadership. These are very broad meetings to walk people through what this meant and how it could impact jobs and what it meant for our culture, for our social programs, much of which unfortunately proved to be true. Right. And remember, in Ontario in 1990, it was the NDP that was swept into power. So there's no question when Brian Mulroney won two back-to-back majority governments, there were obviously some working people who must have supported him.
Of course, yes.
And there have always been working people who are more conservative for various reasons. But in 1990 in Ontario, people chose the NDP. And then in 1993, they chose Jean Chrétien, the Liberals, who campaigned on a very progressive agenda, national childcare program, housing, all kinds of benefits, which of course they they turned their back on once they got in and made the deepest social spending cuts we had faced. And in 1995, I think in reaction to the Bob Rae government and even during his government, there was a strong reaction to what I would call identity politics. Hmm. And that really helped fuel the Harris government's victory, the majority government for Mike Harris in 1995.
So if we jump ahead, I'm jumping sort of ahead. There's a lot more in the book. We're just really scratching the surface.
We're going chronologically. Here. It's very impressive.
So if we jump ahead to the 21st century, the book is separated into two parts. There's chapters within each part, but chapter or part two is the 21st century. And I'm curious just about participation in unions in the 21st century. Participation is down across the country. Like, fewer workers are in unionized environments now than they were in the 1980s, for instance. So how does that transformation affect the Canadian Auto Workers Union specifically? And how are women fighting back against this decline in participation?
Well, one of the consequences of free trade and the loss of the Auto Pact, the 1965 Auto Pact, was the loss of a lot of manufacturing jobs, including auto. And if you look at the erosion of union representation in the private sector, it's quite steep. Where it has held steady, and overall the numbers are steady, is in the public sector. And of course, the public sector is made up of firefighters and police and, you know, public servants. There's all kinds of folks there, but there are more women in the public sector. Think healthcare, childcare, education, libraries. And I think that, you know, there was, as private sector unions really faced incredible headwinds and loss of jobs, they were fighting back, but it became incredibly difficult. And not only men lost jobs in the private sector, a lot of women lost jobs as well, textile and all kinds of other manufacturing. But I think you saw a lower representation of manufacturing workers and fewer men. And now many of the labor leaders today are women. So I think you have seen this rise of the public sector, which I think started in the 1960s. But you see it today that there are more. The head of the Ontario Public Service Union is a woman, the Ontario Federation of Labor, and eventually, and we write about this, the head of the Canadian Auto Workers Union for the first time is a woman.
In that environment, though, as we sit here in 2025, we're in a moment of a rise of populism, a relationship, an economic relationship, at the very least, between Canada and the United States that is, let's say, strained, for lack of a better term. How is the labor movement, like, how is the Canadian auto workers, how can they navigate the space where there's so much external to the workers? It seems like a lot of people are frustrated that labor has been completely discounted in these broader discussions, and that the concerns of individuals who just want to go to work every day and have a good job, that they're being set aside in the face of these larger geopolitical and economic issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is true that for the last few decades, there have been huge geopolitical forces at play, and it has made life harder and harder for the average working person. I think today a lot of people feel it's hard to make ends meet, life is less affordable. But, you know, organized labor still plays an important role. Lena Payne, the head of the Auto Workers Union, is on the Prime Minister's Economic Council, I think they call it. So she's someone who can pick up the phone and get the ear of the prime minister or the premier or any provincial premiers. And that is because of the power of that organization, which goes back to the CIO years. And it's really the numbers, the concentrated numbers. But I will say today that the proportion of the union that is made up of private sector manufacturing is much less. There have been a number of mergers over the years there, because the union now is called Unifor. So it now includes resource extraction, energy workers, media workers, healthcare, hospitality, hotels. So it's a very diverse union, mostly private, but still a lot of public sector. And it is the power of those numbers that gives Lena Payne her voice. And I think we need it more than ever now. We need those progressive voices, whether it's Laura Walton at the OFL or J.P. Hornick at OPSU. You need those progressive voices fighting back because, you know, I see we're in this terrific pressure point with the U.S. and people are saying, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to negotiate this? And business comes up with solutions that we've heard for decades. Deregulate, cut taxes, cut back on workers' pay, need to have some more pipelines, more mines, invest in defense. I don't think that is going to help the average person put food on the table or pay their bills. So, you know, I'm now working with the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, where we offer progressive alternatives to the dominant economic policy and social policy. But it is the organized force of labor that really has the ability to marshal numbers and push back against that agenda. It's not always successful, but it means that those pushing for more austerity and tax cuts don't get a free ride. And every so often you win gains. We do have a national childcare program now. It's imperfect, but every so often you can push through and make progress. And I think, you know, our mothers and grandmothers would be proud that is a possibility today when it's something they've been, you know, the old timers in the union, when I was active, the old time women used to go to me and say, what are you doing? We still don't have a childcare program yet. Like, get out there, fight for that. And we did. It just took a lot longer than we thought it was going to take.
Now, just to get off the book here as for the last question, and certainly, as I said, we're just scratching the surface of what's in the book. But I'm curious, because you were a senior negotiator with the union, could you take us into the room a little bit of you sit down, the employer's there. I mean, you have however many thousands of people who've probably talked to you and said, oh, I want this. I'm interested in this. This is my priority. And your job then is to go in and negotiate against the employer. Just what is the atmosphere in a negotiation like? And how do you, on the union side as a negotiator, try to take all of the things that I'm sure you hear from members and put it into a coherent message as you're negotiating with an employer?
Yeah, that's a great question. It is a fascinating, wonderful process. And it is complicated. It's not one person. It's all of the leadership in the workplaces, and they're consulting, they're having meetings, there are votes on what people want, all kinds of input that people get. And there will be a bargaining convention where issues are debated. What are the priorities of the union? What are we going to go after? And part of the power of the auto sector is the structure of a master agreement. So it's not one workplace, because if one plant goes on strike, for example, the others can ramp up, but it's a master agreement for all of that company. Now, there's no question there's a smaller footprint for each company than there used to be, but there are master agreements, which means each workplace in Canada for that company, they all bargain at the same time. And they have a master committee, which is in charge of the overall big economic issues. And then there are local committees that deal with the in-plant issues. So there's a huge amount of preparation and consultation that goes into this, so that when the union says, okay, these are our demands, these are our national demands, these are our workplace demands, union leaders have a pretty good idea what their members are looking for. Now, if we were bargaining with ourselves, we could just get all those things, but we're bargaining with an employer. So there's discussions and consultation with the employer that goes in ahead of time. We need to really analyze their economic situation and see what their challenges are, what's coming down the pipe in terms of new products that our members can build. And it's just a really complex process, but I find it fascinating. It doesn't always work without a strike. Sometimes there is a strike, and that's, you know, it's very challenging for people. They don't get a paycheck. They get a much smaller amount of money on strike pay. And you never know how these things are going to end. But the vast majority of agreements in auto have been resolved without a strike. And, you know, in the past, the record speaks for itself, the gains that workers have made. They had health care before we had Medicare. They had dental care. They had all kinds of provisions that the average worker didn't have access to. But the motto of the union was always, what we want for ourselves, we want for all. So that's why there was always public pressure on governments to make these social changes.
Yeah, and just seeing how important unions are, even for, as you say, workplaces that aren't necessarily unionized, the impact goes well beyond just that particular workplace or that particular industry. And it's why everybody should go and pick up the book. Again, it's Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union. Peggy, if people want a copy of the book or pick up a copy of your other book, award-winning, Women Winning Office, your guide, activist guide to getting elected, how can people do that?
People can do that by going to your local independent bookstore. And if they don't have it on the shelf, they'll order it for you. You can order it from the publisher, which is Between the Lines. Their motto is Books Without Bosses. So I thought that was very appropriate. Or the main online platforms can get it for you as well. But I encourage you to support your local bookstores.
Yes, and we will link to the Beyond Between the Lines link page for the book in the show notes below, so be sure to check it out. Peggy Nash, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a pleasure, Sean. Thank you so much.
So there you have it, my chat with Peggy Nash, and I thank her for her time. And again, the book is Women United, Stories of Women's Struggles for Equality in the Canadian Auto Workers Union. And with that, let's get right to today's historical headline of the week, which, a little different this week, going to come from Stats Canada. A post by Renee Morissette entitled Unionization in Canada, 1981 to 2022. Posted on November the 23rd, 2022. And this piece goes through that decrease in unionization that I talked about with Peggy. But what's fascinating is it looks at different segments of the population and notes that the percentage of unionization for men in the workforce fell by 16 percentage points over that time, but remained stable for women. And even gets more granular in looking at age groups. So for men, the unionization rate fell more for men aged 25 to 34 between 1981 and 1997, whereas for men 45 to 54, the unionization rate fell mainly from 1997 to 2022. Similarly, the greatest rate of unionization drop for men between ages 45 and 54 was 17 percentage points. Women of that same age range, only 4%. So that gives a bit of an insight into the type of labor where unionization decreased more, the different sectors that were hit at different times with a decrease in unionization. And it also, I think, gives a really good insight into what Peggy and Julie are talking about in this book in terms of the power and the influence of women throughout the 20th century, but particularly in this era covered by this study, as the rate of unionization of women labor is the same over the period, but men's labor is decreasing. So when you put that into the context of the union, it just further highlights how significant the contributions of women were, again, not only within these unionized workplaces, but the extension of that influence beyond unionized workplaces, because things that unions get tend to, not always, but tend to find their way into non-unionized workplaces as well. So a really fascinating profile here from Stats Canada. I know it's not normal historical headline of the week, but I think this one adds a lot of very valuable context to what we talked about with Peggy and to the book overall. So today's historical headline of the week from Stats Canada, Renee Morissette, Unionization in Canada, 1981 to 2022. from November 23rd, 2022. And with that, I'll say thank you very much for listening, everybody. If you have not yet, please do subscribe wherever you get your podcast, like, rate, comment. All that good stuff helps other people find the show, keeps us growing. Of course, head on over to activehistory.ca. All of our past episodes are there under the podcast tab and all the great written material over on the website. And as always, if you want to let me know what you want to hear on the show, what's oldest news at gmail.com. So I'll say thanks again for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you again next week for more What's Old Is News.